Well, we're looking at Jonah, chapter 1, and looking at verse 5. We left off last week, and Jonah is in the belly of the ship. Later on, he's going to be in the belly of the fish. He's going to spend all his time in the belly of something. But we left the ship facing a great wind that became a mighty tempest. And it was such that the ship was about to be broken up in pieces. So it's in dire straits. So we come to verse 5, and verse 5 says, "Then the mariners were afraid and cried every man unto his God, and cast forth the wares that were in the ship into the sea to lighten it of them. But Jonah was gone down into the sides of the ship, and he lay and was fast asleep." Well, he's sleeping through all of this. That in itself is really something. You really see here in this verse two things. You see the pagans that are praying and the prophet that is sleeping. Like, one group is praying and they don't know God, and one individual is sleeping who does know God. Should be. So, and you see those that are afraid of God, and those that, and one that doesn't seem to be afraid of God. You see those that are aware of God, and somebody who's not aware of God. Everything's backwards, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So we look at the pagans praying here, and you see the first thing that you see is their fear. That's what causes them to pray, because it says here, "And then the mariners were afraid." Of course, mariners just means sailors, but it says they were afraid. And there are two kinds of fear when you look up that word fear. One definition of fear is reverence and awe, and sometimes it's translated fear. And the other definition for fear is terror and dread. And fear really is, I was thinking about this when I was looking over my lesson, I thought fear is like these two sets of emotions, that one's positive and one's negative. They're like two sides of the same coin. You know, fear is just one coin, and on one side you have this set of emotions, which would be reverence and awe, and on the other side you have the other set of emotions, which is terror and dread. Depending on your attitude towards God, if you know Him, you'll feel one or the other. The thing is, men at one point in time will feel one or more of those emotions. And the sailors here, I don't think they felt reverence and awe, because that's a positive emotion. They felt the negative aspect of what fear is about. Because they just saw how helpless they were and how hopeless they were. And the point being, this is a place God really must bring every man to before He does the very next thing that they do, which is cry out. So he brings them to a place where they are afraid. And it's only when they are afraid that they come to this place where they cry out. And that's sometimes what it takes for people to cry out unto God. Circumstances have to be so bad that you're left with, what else can I do? But I can cry out to God. And so we see their fear. They were afraid. That's just a fact. And there's nothing wrong with that, because, of course, the ship was about to be wrecked and they were about to die. So that's a natural feeling. And so they do something, which is what they should do. They cried out, which is prayed, is really what they're doing. they're praying, but every man cried unto his own God. It says, and they cried every man unto his God. And just like there are two different aspects of fear, where you have awe and reverence and terror and dread, there are two different aspects of crying out. You can cry out in fear, or you can cry out in faith. And obviously, fear is motivating their cry and not faith. Although, since they're calling upon a god, one of their gods, there's kind of a degree of faith there. But they're going to find out that it's not enough.
Nothing to be
It
faith,
isn't, there's
have
nothing,
faith in.
yeah, there's nothing that they can have faith in and trust in that will really help them in their situation.
Well, they have faith in it, that whatever it is, they're going to do it.
Because whatever cry they make, and I don't know how long this goes on before finally they say, you know, there's this guy down in the belly of the ship, let's get him to cry out to his God too. But what struck me is every man did this. Every man cried out, every man prayed. So they're unified. All of the men prayed, and I think they were all earnest and desperate in their prayers. And that shows you that men will pray in a time of crisis. Sometimes it just takes that before they will finally pray or look to God. Men will pray in a time of fear. And sometimes men will pray because it's a time of zeal. They're very zealous. And we find that they are, I guess, at this point in time when they pray, religious men. They have a religion because they have a God. So obviously, maybe they weren't really religious until this circumstance arose, and now I'm religious. Now I'm going to pray and call upon my God. Could be they ignored their gods up until this time. But these are religious men. They're unified men, and they're religious men. And each man prayed to his own personal God, or gods, plural. And you know, I looked up, and in that time frame, people had their own personal deities that were special to them, that meant something to them. And there were national deities, not just personal deities. There were deities for that particular nation that you would pray to. And there were storm deities, specific deities that pertained to storms. So, you know, they were either praying to a personal deity or a national deity or also to a storm deity or to all of
All
those
three.
deities. I'm going to cover all my bases, and I'm just going to pray to everybody that I can. My Bible dictionary said, as Canaan was a land of tempest, the high-ranking deities of the Canaanite pantheons were storm gods. You know, they had quite a few number of storm gods. So they could have prayed to one or more of those storm gods. Baal was a storm god, one of the storm gods. Storm gods were conceived of as vigorous warriors that were revered for their ability to usher in the rains, you know, needed to fertilize the land. But they were also feared for their destructive power that was unleashed in a storm. Well, these are sailors, so the deity that they're going to pray to is not the deity that's going to send rain on the land. It's the deity that is stirring up the storm on the sea. It would be like the Greeks, Poseidon was the god of the ocean, and the sailors would often pray to him. Musicians would pray to another god, and healers would pray to another god, and mothers would pray to another god, and so forth. They're desperate. I don't know who they're praying to, but I think they're praying to everybody that they can. My point being is that I'm really struck by the fact that the Lord really uses circumstances to get people to pray first so that he can get their attention. And even though they're praying to the wrong gods, when it's all said and done at the end of this chapter, they're going to be praying to the right God because they'll know who he is. Because Jonah will tell them who he is. And the circumstances that we are in will determine the tone of the prayer that we utter before the one that we're praying to. And this is a little bit like other pagans in the land. You can be a religious pagan and a zealous pagan, and you can really pray with zeal, and it's not going to get you anywhere. And the best example I thought of that we're very familiar with is when Elijah had the confrontation with the prophets of Baal for the hearts of Israel. And the sacrifice was laid upon the altar, and the priests of Baal were very fervent in their prayers, very zealous in their prayers. And we find that 1 Kings 18:26 says, "And they took the bullock which was given them, and they dressed it, and called on the name of Baal from morning even until noon, saying, O Baal, hear us. But there was no voice, nor any that answered. And they leaped upon the altar that was made." And of course, they shouted, and they yelled, and they cut themselves, and they just did this until they were exhausted. And what does Elijah do? He just stands back and he mocks them. Well, you know, maybe he's sleeping, or maybe he's deaf, or you know, maybe he's on an errand. Or and he just mocks them. Point being that you can pray unto your gods, every man his gods, and you can have zeal behind that prayer. It doesn't matter how zealous you are. If it is a god that is not God, no amount of zeal and fervor and emotion that's attached to it is going to get you anywhere. And I'm sure that they were zealous when they prayed and earnest when they prayed, because they were desperate when they prayed. And yet, like the priests of Baal, it didn't get them anywhere. The storm was still tossing that ship to and fro. There again, you see the restraint of the Lord, because he makes sure that the ship is not broken up until they get Jonah on board, above board, and they can talk to him. So it's just right at a critical point, but it never goes beyond that critical point where a board cracks and everything buckles. So the Lord attacks the ship, but he preserves the ship at the same time. That's just his wonderful restraint. So every nation worshiped gods, but only one nation knew who the true God was and the real God was, and that was Israel. And what you see here is when it says in this particular verse, every man cried unto his God. It doesn't say one of them cried unto God, the God of Israel. Not one does it say cried unto Jehovah God. And why do you think that was?
Well,
they didn't know him. Didn't know who he was. Or if they had even heard of him, they didn't believe in him. And it didn't even cross their minds to do as the Greeks did. Well, we have an unknown God that we pray to. They didn't do that. They were kind of locked into who it was they were going to pray to. Not one sailor knew what Jonah knew. But the thing is, where was Jonah? He hid inside that ship. He wasn't on top of the ship. And when he hid in the ship, what he was doing was hiding who he was and hiding what he knew. He was down below in the belly of the ship, hiding. And whether he realized it or not, he was hiding who he was and what he knew. And if he had been on top when the storm first arose, he could have been like Paul and said, "Be not afraid." And comforted their hearts and strengthened their hearts. So he's hiding. But the Lord's not going to let him hide for long. So the next thing that you see after you see their fear and you see their cry, you're going to see the next thing that happens, which is kind of a progression of what happens when you come into a crisis. There's this loss that they will experience. You know, whatever the crisis may be, here it is a ship under duress, being tossed about by terrible winds. There is this fear, and then there is this cry, and then you come to the end of yourself where you're going to lose everything. I'm willing to lose everything if I can just keep my life. And really, that's what they're going to do. There is this loss that they will experience, because it says they cast forth the wares that were in the ship into the sea. You know, and cast forth just means what it says. They threw it out. It shows, you know, their desperation. It shows the energy behind that desperation. Everybody probably grabbed something, and they just started throwing it overboard, and they didn't care what it was that they threw overboard, because they're trying to make the ship lighter. So this was more than this was not a passenger ship that he was on. It was really a cargo ship, and sometimes cargo ships would take a passenger or two,
yeah,
make a little money.
Thing, yeah.
But the whole purpose of that ship was we're transporting goods. So whether they were transporting wine or grain or oil or olives or gold or silver or cloths or clothing or pottery or jewels, whatever they were trading, and it was probably a variety of things, they're about to lose everything that would give them a profit if they can just save the ship.
What you do, lighten the load.
That's what you do. And they're throwing it into the sea. Does that mean they'll ever recover it again? No? The point is, the sea can take the ship, or the sea can take what's in the ship. Let the sea take what's in the ship, and let the ship remain and not be swallowed up by the sea. So they chose to try to keep the ship, even though they were going to lose everything else. So they cast the goods that were in the ship into the sea, or they cast the cargo overboard. And they're forced by judgment to let go of everything in order to save their lives. Sometimes the Lord brings people to this place where they have to let go of everything in order to live. They wanted to live and not to die at whatever the cost. I don't care if I'm poor as a pauper when this ship lands, as long as this ship hits land and I'm alive, that's all that matters. And this is what every man must do. They have to let go of everything and cry out unto the Lord. So that's another aspect of how the Lord is reaching out to touch their hearts. Let go of all these things. And sometimes the Lord just forcibly has to strip away those things from us because you're hanging on to them. And it takes a lot for them to let go of those things. And even in the lives of God's people. It's going to take a lot for Jonah to let go of those things that he's hanging on to. Jesus taught, when he spoke about the greediness of man, he taught that it's really hard for a man who is wealthy and who is greedy and whose soul is caught up in that those things, it's hard for him to let go of that wealth. And remember, that shows that it's really easy to fix our eyes on those things. And if you have your eyes fixed on those things, it's really hard to let go of those things. And Jesus talks about this man that says in Luke 12:19, "Well, I will say unto my soul, soul, thou hast much goods. And it's laid up for many years. Take thine ease and eat and drink and be merry. But God said unto him," what? "Thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then who shall those things be which thou hast provided?" That's what's happening to these sailors. And it's just a lesson that the Lord's teaching them. This has many levels and layers to it, or facets to it.
He's not just dealing with Jonah, huh?
Right, he's not just dealing with Jonah, he's dealing with these sailors. The Lord uses everything, and when he teaches a lesson, it's not just for one person. If those surrounding that person that the Lord's working with have a hard attitude, they'll learn a lesson too, because they're in contact with him, or in close proximity to him. And the Apostle Paul, you know, saw that nothing in this world had any value compared to Christ. And he learned to let go of those things. And I don't think he had any regrets. I don't think he looked back afterwards and said, "Oh, I wished I hadn't let go of that." Or, "I wished I still had that status." A lot of the things that the Apostle Paul let go of that he talked about in Philippians 3 were religious things. Although I'm sure he had money to start out with. But the things that he let go of were religious things. And Paul said, all those things that I thought were gain are what? I count them as loss. And I count how many things? All things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus. So the Apostle Paul understood what really had value. He learned that lesson. One of the things that they're going to have to throw overboard that they're not physical, is a physical thing, is they're going to have to throw their idolatry overboard. They're going to have to throw their trust in their gods overboard, because when it's all said and done, they're going to see how weak their gods are and how mighty the God of Jonah is. You know, there comes a time when each man must choose between the world and the Word. To choose between the God of this world, or I guess you could say to choose between the God of this world, small g, or the God of this world, big G. G, capital G-O-D, God of this world. And we find the reason that they were throwing everything overboard was to lighten it, to make the ship lighter. And that really is a common practice among sailors. You see that in Acts 27 when the Apostle Paul was in that ship getting ready to go to Rome, and they hit that great storm, and the ship was being tossed about, and actually the ship did break up, but all the men were left alive. But the first things that the sailors did in Acts 27:18 is, and they being exceedingly tossed with the tempest, the next day they lightened the ship. That's something that they did. And the third day we cast out with our own hands the tackling or the furniture of the ship. So, you know, they just threw away everything that they could in order to make the ship lighter so it wouldn't flounder. And this is kind of a last desperate effort to save themselves. So the Lord's going to bring them right to the edge of destruction. And they need to be that desperate before, for some reason, they think of this passenger down below. Where is he? Why isn't he above board? Let's go ask him to come and pray. The captain's going to go to him and say, you need to go pray to your God here. We're in big trouble here. But they're going to be pretty desperate before they think about this man down below that's hidden. Which shows you that no matter how much you hide yourself from God, his word or his will or what he wants you to do, there's going to come a time when he's going to force you into the open and force you to take a stand for who you are and what you are. And Jonah may be hiding, but he's going to be dragged out of the belly of that ship on the deck, and he's going to face all those sailors, and he's going to face that storm. So you can hide for a while, but the Lord's going to make sure sometimes that there's no more hiding. You need to face things. And so we look at the prophet who is sleeping. We've seen the pagans who are praying. Now we see the prophet who is sleeping. And where is he? What, he is gone down again into the sides of the ship. You know, every time we see Jonah doing something, he keeps going down. He goes down to Joppa. He goes down to the ship and goes into it. And now he's down inside the sides of the ship. When you go down, he's gotten to so far down, there's no other place to go except the ocean or the sea. And he's going to go down there too. But he'll still be in the belly of something, so the Lord's preserving him. It's just not going to be quite as secure and comfortable as in the belly of the ship. That's just amazing how the Lord does this. But he's deep inside the ship, and eventually he's going to be deep inside the belly of the fish. He was down in the sides of the ship, or the rear of the ship, in the very recesses or deep inside the ship. And I like to think of it as the belly of the ship. He's just right down there in that hollow part of the ship. And most commentators say it's right at the tail end of the ship. So And what was he doing down in that ship? He lay there and he was what? Fast asleep.
Tired from all that running.
Yeah, I really think so. I'm sure he's been running. And probably depressed, and when you're depressed, you get tired, and you think, I'll just forget about it and sleep, and I won't have to think about it. But he lay down in a dark place and a hidden place, because it's dark, it's hidden, and he probably thought, I'm safe, I'm secure, I'm hidden out of sight. Like, duh, the Lord can see you there. But he lay down exhausted, because I think, as Don said, he was running, and he was running from God's will. And he had no spiritual strength, and he had no spiritual purpose. So there's this, not just physical exhaustion, but there is this spiritual exhaustion that comes from fighting against God and struggling against God. You wear yourself out. You can't win. So I think he was both physically exhausted and spiritually exhausted. So he went down into the inner part of the ship, or he went down into the hold of the ship, and he lay down there, and he lay down in a dark place, away from everybody. You go to sleep. And he wasn't just asleep, he was what? Fast asleep. I mean, you know, when you lay down, depending on the degree of your tiredness, there are different levels of sleep where you won't hear a thing that's going on around you, or if you're, it's a light sleep, you know, I can hear little things in the house and, you know, I'll wake up. But if it's a deep sleep, if you wake up from a deep sleep, it's like, where am I and what day is this? And it's like you're really disoriented because you are just out. So he was fast asleep, and that word fast asleep comes from a word that means to stun, to paralyze, to knock out. I mean, he was out. Out like a light. It is a deep sleep. It is speaks of being unconscious. So he's in such a deep sleep that obviously he doesn't feel the storm or the ship. Yeah, he's. You think he would, but because you would feel it down there. But he was so deeply asleep that the storm did not wake him. Which is sad, because the storm is one way that God is speaking to him. So he's so deeply asleep that he can't hear the Lord speak to him, even in that way. So he was, when you look up being deeply asleep, one way of a word that describes that is impervious. You're impervious. And impervious means you are unreceptive or unmoved. And he was oblivious. And oblivious means you're just unresponsive and unconscious. And, you know, he was both. He was impervious and oblivious. You know, nothing moved him, nothing shook him, and it's because he just wasn't aware of what was going on around him. It's going to take a lot. It's going to take the captain coming down and shaking him and waking him and saying, do you see what's going on around you? Brother Warren Wiersbe says, Jonah went down into the sides of the ship, and he lay, and he was fast asleep. Jonah had lost his spiritual energy. He went to sleep during a fierce storm and was totally unconcerned about the safety of others. The sailors were throwing the ship's wares and cargo overboard, and Jonah was about to lose everything, but he still slept on. And he quotes Proverbs 24:33, which you're familiar with, which says, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit and scarcity like an armed man. You can kind of see the stages there, you know. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands. You know, just slipping into it. And something overtakes you. Jonah didn't see the danger while he was asleep, did he? And the sailors were awake and they saw the danger. A sad testimony that they are awake and they're praying, and he's asleep, and he's not aware of it. God's going to use the sailors to, in a sense, shame Jonah and chastise Jonah. And really, isn't that what the Gentiles are doing today that believe on the Lord? They are shaming and chastising Israel for their failure, for their for being impervious and oblivious to what God is doing. And Paul knew that. And rather than them turning back to the Lord, they got even more hard-hearted. So I thought about people that fell asleep, and because they fell asleep, something happened to them and it wasn't good. And remember in Judges 4:21, Sisera was asleep in the tent, and Jael came and she slew him. Remember that? Judges 4:21 says he was fast asleep and he was weary. She gave him something warm to drink, or warm curds, I think, or warm milk. And he lay down and he went to sleep, and she took a hammer in her hand and she smote him in his temples with that nail and fastened it to the ground. That took a little bit of strength and effort. And it says, for he was fast asleep and weary, and so he died. He was fast asleep and so he died. So he paid a price for being asleep. Samson fell asleep on Delilah's knees, and what did she do to his hair? She cut his hair. Now Judges 16:19 says she made him sleep upon her knees. It's not like he was weary or he was tired. He was kind of lulled into it and coerced into it. But he fell asleep, and he paid a price for that, because she cut his hair, and then he ended up being bound and imprisoned. When Jesus was praying, the disciples fell asleep. And you see that in Matthew 26:40, because he came to his disciples and he found them asleep. And, oh, he said, couldn't you just watch with me a little hour? If they had kept awake and watched, think of how strengthened they would have been and how less fearful they would have been. But they were asleep, and so when he was taken, they all fled. And saints today can be asleep to what's going on around them. And we need to be awake. Romans 13:11 says, and that knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now is our salvation. Or one rendering of that is, for now is the completion of our salvation, which is our glorification. And now is that nearer than when we first believed? Now we need to awake out of sleep. We need to be awake and watch. And the Apostle Paul really emphasizes the importance of that. You know, sleep can be a sign of physical weariness or spiritual weariness. And I think Jonah was both physically tired from running and spiritually tired from resisting God. And therefore, we find him sound asleep in the midst of circumstances. But the Lord's going to bring him on board, above board, and give him an opportunity. And I think it's rather grudging. And it's rather telling that he's going to be witnessing to Gentiles. Oh my goodness. Just the people he really doesn't want to witness to. Because the Ninevites were Gentiles and they were pagans. And here he is getting a lesson in witnessing to pagans. And what are they going to do? They're going to do what the Ninevites do. They're going to turn to God. So he's getting a little foreshadow what's going to happen when he goes to Nineveh. You just catch a glimpse of that.